Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
This episode of A Taste of the Past is brought to you by Bob's Red Mill, encouraging you to eat healthfully and nutritionally. Visit bobsredmill.com to learn more about their products. And use the code TASTE25 for 25% off your order.
I'm HRN's Executive Director, Katie Mosman-Wadler, with a preview of this week's episode of Meat and Three, our weekly food news roundup. Kat Johnson kicked the season off with an episode about food and football, so now we're turning to one of my favorite sports, talking about cookbooks. We'll take a sneak peek at a few recipe breakthroughs that Rose Levy Barenbaum discovered while working on her 12th cookbook.
You know, so this was such a eureka thing. People ask me if I still keep learning, and yeah, just thinking about it and trying to find a better way. It happens.
And hear about the challenges of writing a book about alcohol from HRN host Souther Teague.
The history of drinking is very blurry because people were drinking and no one was taking notes.
Plus, we'll get all the expert dish about the most exciting cookbook titles heading to bookstores this fall.
Like jazz music, it's been a part of American cuisine for centuries.
Subscribe to Meat and Three wherever you listen to podcasts and be the first to know when the next episode drops.
Hi, and welcome to A Taste of the Past. I'm your host, Linda Palacio, on this culinary journey through culinary history on Heritage Radio Network. And before we begin today, I would like to give a fond farewell, no, a cheery send-off to our respected engineer, David Tatasciore. This is David Tatasciore's last day at Heritage Radio Network, and he's on to, I hope, bigger and better things and climbing the career of radio engineering. And I thank him for all the years of service he gave here at Heritage Radio and helping to make me sound good.
That's easy, Linda.
Thanks, David, and good luck and best wishes in everything you do.
Thank you.
You're welcome. And today, we have a show for anyone, and I would imagine that includes just about anyone, interested in the heritage of Egypt's cuisine. When you think of Egypt, you think, oh my goodness, that's so old. How could anyone know? Well, yes, very old. And now there's a new source for research into the medieval period, which really, I think, cemented a lot of the culinary heritage for Egypt, but I'll ask that question to my guest. The new source is the very first English language best English language translation of a medieval Egyptian cookbook entitled Treasure Trove of Benefits and Variety at the Table, a 14th century Egyptian cookbook. This is quite a work that was undertaken, and this book, referred to as the Khans al-Fawaid, I don't know if I'm saying that quite right, but we'll find that out too.
Fawaid.
Okay, Fawaid. All right there. Thank you. The original Arabic manuscript of this cookbook of over 800 recipes was written by, as far as we know, an anonymous author during Egypt's middle era. And with its comprehensive array of recipes, it also contains a full range of the Egyptian culinary heritage as well. And it tells us a lot about the culture of the times in Egypt, in Cairo. And the book remained largely unknown. It was translated and edited, I think, what is it? Well, we'll find that, I think, in 93, but it wasn't really very accurate, and we'll find out why. And then the most recent version was undertaken by Iraqi scholar, my guest, as you hear her giggling at my presumptions in the background, Nawal Nasrallah. She has written an extensive introduction and a glossary and added photographs and modernizations of recipes and has just done, and I can't even imagine the job of translating this compendium of recipes, instructions, descriptions. And she's also a food blogger and an avid cook, and she is no stranger to interpreting ancient recipes. She translated the Annals of Caliph's Kitchens, the Al-Warraq 10th century Baghdadi cookbook. And her previous book, which she was on to talk about several years ago, is called Delights from the Garden of Eden, a cookbook and history of Iraqi cuisine. Nawal taught English at the universities of Mosul and Baghdad in Iraq before moving to the States in late 90s. And she was often asked by her American friends about Iraqi recipes and the lack of resources on the topic in the U.S. That led her to write and research Arabic culinary culture. Welcome, Nawal.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Well, congratulations on this monumental achievement. I don't know if I quite managed to convey that, but what a book. And I have to say, the book is also eminently cookable. Can one say cookable? not always the case. In doing a lot of research and looking at ancient texts or medieval texts, you get ideas of dishes, but you really couldn't, stand in your kitchen and cook from them. But this one is actually, cookable. I have a couple dishes I can't wait to try.
I agree, totally agree. I mean, that's why I added an appendix with the 22 modernized recipes, just to give, to encourage others to discover other recipes and to try them for themselves, because they are really worth trying.
Well, and I hope that you'll do more and post them on your blog as you go along.
Well, as I have the time,
Okay.
I intend to.
Well, because this book sort of stayed in obscurity to the Western world, at least for so long, what were the challenges that were presented in translating the work?
Well, it is the, of course, we have an edited text. I mean, that talk was about it. I mean, it was said that there was an Egyptian cookbook, Kanzil Fawa'id, by Maxim Rodinson in the 1948 and before him, so we know there is such a manuscript. But then it waited for so long until 1993 and until it was edited, the Arabic edition by Manuela Marin and David Waynes. So it came out in 1993. And then it waited until 2018 or end of 2017 until this English. I mean, it's not only the first English translation, but the only translation that, saw the light, after the edited edition.
Right.
Well, the edited edition was very helpful for me because they did a meticulous research and, reading of the texts. We have five manuscripts, and they worked on them, and they have thousands of footnotes appended to their edited edition where they give the variations of the texts, and so that was helpful for me because I could see that in the edited text, the printed one, I can do a better choice if I use the other choice they have in the appendix, so that helped a lot.
Mm-hmm. Well, but now still, Arabic. Yeah. I mean, Arabic is your native language, but still, you were presented with a lot of different
challenges.
Variations, and yeah, right.
Yeah, there were a lot of challenges simply because the copies we have, none of them was in perfect condition.
Mm.
They had certain lacunas. They had certain incorrectly copied words. I discovered that one of the copyists, he just skipped a folio and then he jumped to the other, just like two pages. And then I discovered, I mean, I looked at the recipe and I say, I mean, the last four lines do not belong here. They do not make sense. So what's happening here? So luckily, I was able to get a manuscript that the editor didn't use. I got it from, it's in a German library. So when I got it, I realized that, oh boy, this copyist, they have skipped pages, two pages, and then he jumped to the other recipe. So I was able to find the missing recipes and find the beginning of the four lines at the end of this recipe. So it was so messy. Sometimes it drove me mad, trying to see the connections and so. But, one has to be patient, and I have to, believe that basically the text was good. Because the problem is that the copies we have is not the original manuscript that the original writer wrote. It is a copy from a copy from a copy. So by passage of time, of course, things change, and the readers and the copyists after like 300 years or something, they no longer recognize the words. They cannot, so they just jot down anything, or the reader wasn't able to read a word and he just gave him another word. So, they just take liberties, but it really poses a problem for modern readers.
Right.
So I have to go through all these problems, and I'm glad that I, 97 of the problems I managed to solve.
Well, now, in saying that, well, we didn't have the original, we don't have the original manuscript, does it exist, the original, somewhere?
No.
Yeah, it's long gone.
No, we only have, one is from the 17th century, the others don't have dates, and mm-hmm. so they are, they come, the ones we have are, they come as a series of recopying.
Mm-hmm. Now, from reading all of the different versions, are you of the belief that it was really under one author's pen?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, I'm convinced that it was written by one person, because he gave me the impression that he had a plan. He gives the in his introduction, he gives the kind of survey of the chapters he covered, and he said, I chose to call it Kenz al-Fawa'id fi Tanwi' al-Mawa'id, and then he goes on, with his chapters. I didn't see that it was like a patched work or something.
Uh-huh. So the style was stayed,
yes,
pretty much the
well,
same.
Well, the style, I cannot say about the style, because when we talk about how he wrote it, we'll realize that it's copying.
Yes.
But he did some, I assume he did some editing, but, it's just a, regular style, simple style. He wasn't after a literary effect or something, so it wasn't a problem, the style.
Do you think that he was a chef in a home, perhaps a royal home, or...?
I don't get this impression. The impression I get of the writer, anonymous as he is, mm-hmm. just what I, the impression I got is that he was a kind of scribe, what we call mm-hmm. katib. He was interested, he was a gourmet, and he was interested in writing a kind of book that was in demand, that sells. And he had access to several manuals, so he put it together. That was the way they did the books.
Okay. Well, you mentioned that they were probably drawn from several different pamphlets, and that.
Yes,
and
what?
So, what you meant by pamphlets were just different versions on certain foods that would have been dispersed throughout the community.
Well, for example, he has a chapter on pickles.
Mm-hmm.
It has a lot, more than 30 recipes on pickles. So I think that they used to write, for example, at the time, certain small books for picklers so that they can use it when they make pickles.
Yeah, much like we have today. I mean,
specialized booklets for fermented sauces, booklets for desserts, and so on. So he had access to all these, and he put them together. And what struck me is that his aim from the title, you know that he wants to put as many recipes as possible. He called it Kenz el Fawaid, which is the treasure trove. It is indeed a treasure trove.
Yes.
Yes, because those pamphlets, none of them, I'm not aware of those pamphlets, pickling pamphlets or fermented sauces or the dessert, none of them survived, you know, only his book survived. So it's really a treasure.
Yeah. Well, who do you think the book was intended for?
Well, several. Basically, it was intended for households. Of course, you know, households, we'd expect like middle-class households. They have maids, several ones. They have, so they have different hands working in the kitchen. So they could easily put these dishes together because, you know, they are like us. We always like to look for, you know, unusual dishes to surprise others and so on. So they used to, you know, buy these books and try to find the unusual dishes or try perhaps to make perfect some of the dishes they cook or find variations for, you know, basic dish they cook. This is where they find these things, in such books. Also, I also get the impression that such a book would be very useful for apprentices,
mm-hmm.
Looking for training to be cooks. This would be really useful for them, and it would be useful for what else? Also for hired or employed cooks, because in one of the recipes he said, do you want to learn how to present your master with ripe fruits, like a ripe apple or a ripe citron, with the writings in green on it, if you want to do this? And he teaches he gives instructions how to do this. He says, if you do this, you will gain your master's favor. So, he has such people in mind.
Yeah.
Also, in the market, there were different shops, places where you buy ready-cooked foods or where you buy. There were also certain cooks that you go and give them the ingredients. You do the shopping yourself. You give the ingredients to this person, and he cooks those dishes for you.
Oh.
So in the manuals, in the, the market inspection manuals, they say that such cooks, they need to learn how to cook dishes really well before they start their business. So, a lot of people would benefit from this.
Yeah.
And also, such books perhaps, this book was kind of plagiarized. And it appeared in an abridged form in the 15th century. Ironically, we know the person of the plagiarizer, but we don't know the name of the
original author.
Yeah, yes. His name is Ibn Mubarak Shah. He was a famous scholar, and he presented it in an abridged form because he said, I don't like long-windedness. And he said, I am writing this book for the benefit of my own household, for my own slave girls, so that they cook the dish.
Interesting.
Those dishes.
Well,
a lot of people can,
Yeah, to use it. Yeah. Well, and yeah. When you're mentioning about, when you mentioned about perhaps it would be used for people he was training, someone being trained to be a cook, the very opening line, whether that was the original or not, which struck me as almost humorous. The cook must be a very agreeable person.
Yeah. Well, you don't like an angry cook, do you?
Right. And then down to the hygiene of the fingernail. I mean, much like today's manuals for for beginning chefs, the fingernails must be clean and clipped, and really detailed.
I know, and cleaning the the utensils, how to clean them.
Right.
It was very to avoid.
Yeah, I found that you don't see that in cookbooks, even the old texts. In fact, in listening to you lecture one other time on, I guess it was on the Baghdadi cookbook, you have done a lot of interpreting of recipes and you, well, like the cuneiform tablets even.
Yes.
You say that just they're just sort of suggestions of ingredients and that one always assumes that the person reading them already knows how to cook and what to do with them, right?
Yeah, which leads us to the question as what kind of, you know, what level of cooks, you know, you expect to use those books? I mean, definitely such books are not intended for beginners. I mean,
right.
Nowadays we have books that teach you the ABC of cooking, how to how to boil an egg or to do these basic things. No, these books are different. They assume that the cook already knows, you know, the basics. And what you find here is variations on dishes, how to cook them properly. So that's what we have here. Because they, you know, such basics, they were learned orally, you know, from, you know, transmitted from
right.
one generation. You don't need cookbooks for
right.
these things.
Right, and people didn't really, they didn't write, you know, the common person did not read and write, so they it was an oral translation.
Well, they did, yeah. I mean, yeah. I think, you know, that, I mean, they read those books.
I mean earlier on
earlier,
when they
yeah,
were did
yeah.
by oral transmission. You know, you spoke about the cooks in the marketplace being given mm-hmm. the ingredients and cooking the dishes. Give us a little background about what Cairo, the bustling city at the time, what it would have been like in that era of the, you know, the 14th century.
Yeah, well, it's there are a lot of things to say about it. I mean, we are lucky to have a historian, Al-Maqrizi, who really wrote, you know, like volumes on life in Cairo at the time. And we get, you know, a very vivid picture of, you know, of what... life was at least in the, you know, the centers, in the congested city center of Cairo. First of all, you know, we noticed that it was a congested place. I'm talking about, you know, that's just the center, you know, the
right.
centers of the
right.
city. And people lived in kind of, you know, multi-storied buildings, which was, you know, unusual. I mean, I haven't heard of this before reading about these things. And they lived, some of them even lived in just rented rooms. And the first level, you know, the ground level was rented to shops, and they were not connected to the living sections in the above stories. And as such, of course, you cannot... you know, have running water for every single room in this building. So some of them didn't, of course, most of them didn't have kitchens in their rooms or their small apartments, which definitely, of course, necessitated that the presence of the availability of carry out foods, you know,
right.
some like small
So the markets the markets were very important. Still in that era, right?
It's still, yeah, because, you know, not everybody lived in the center. So people had to do their shopping. And Al-Maqrizi describes several bustling, you know, like souks, like they call it aswaq, that's a market. And he mentions, he describes specific ones, you know, like ones he admired. For example, he mentions the street between the two palaces, Bain al-Qasrain. This street, you know, was immortalized in Najib Mahfouz's novels, Between the Two Palaces. This was a kind of thoroughfare. And people sometimes would go not necessarily for shopping, but, you know, go for fun. Mm. And on both sides, you find people selling like grilled pigeons or fried sparrows, wedges of melon. They can buy yogurt. They can buy cheese. So it was fun to go there and buy, you know, those snack foods. There are other, you know, markets where you can do your shopping. Like when they were kind of specialized, there are special places where you can buy your vegetables, your meat, the fish. And, you know, they even say that there were even specialized stalls for just selling, you know, those table herbs,
mm-hmm.
like parsley, the fennel or, you know, like leeks or something. So they were kind of specialized. But in the certain, what they call neighborhood, Hara, certain kind of affluent neighborhoods where they have their own everything, you know, they have everything in their markets. They have their own communal bakery, foreign. They have their bathrooms, public bathrooms, and they have everything they need of what, you know, like they have shops and shops of, selling different things, so they do their shopping. And, you know, people, of course, had to either walk to those, markets, or they can use donkeys. And they were, you know, we read that they were beautifully ornamented and, you know, decorated, and people just hire them and go and do their shopping.
Hmm.
Of course, donkeys, because the horses were just limited, you know, only the military were allowed to use horses, so they had to use donkeys.
So it's interesting. So they really were community centers. I mean, they were the marketplaces.
They were kind of community centers where, you know, in certain neighborhoods.
Yeah,
but in others, there were specialized that if you want fish, you go to the fish market.
Hmm.
And there were certain regulations for the fish market because, you know, if they don't take care, the fish market would stink. So they were asked to to wash their, you know, shops regularly. Any leftover fish from the day has to be salted and sold as salty cured fish so that it doesn't go bad and smell. You know, there are certain regulations for such marketplaces to keep them clean and, you know, usable by people.
Yeah. Well, now, you've because you've done so much work translating the Baghdadi cookbook and then writing your Iraqi cookbook, I'm sure you found a lot of, you know, a common thread and similarities in the types of ingredients and dishes that were presented in this book. But tell us a little bit about the recipes contained within and the descriptions of, and about the diet of the people.
Yeah, well, definitely, I found certain similarities, you know, several similarities between the one I translated in the 10th century and this one in the 14th century. I mean, it is as if it's not like 400 years elapsed between one and the other, you know.
Hmm.
You know, like the stews recipe, they were more or less the same thing. And for example, you know, I found, you know, one of the chapters in Al-Warraq's book, which was 10th century, on the regulations of drinking water, I found exactly the same chapter in this book. And I was, you know, really surprised. I mean, after 400 years, you still find these things. So at the beginning, I doubted that perhaps, you know, I mean, would it be possible that he has copied from Al-Warraq? But that, I mean, the parts that he shares with Al-Warraq are very limited. So when I did my research for this book, I realized that after all, both of them copied from other sources, from other sources that were still circulated, you know, during those 400 years. Like from one of the books by Al-Razi, the famous, the 9th century famous Baghdadi physician,
mm-hmm.
in his book Al-Mansuri, or from recipes, for example, we have for the sick, you know, they are meatless dishes. They are cooked to just, you know, to feed the sick people. They were called muzawarat, you know, counterfeit dishes. I found similar recipes, and I discovered that both of them were copying from al-Baghdadi, also a book by Ibn Butlan. He was called Ibn Abdun, or from Ibn Masawai, you know, other doctors. So apart from such, you know, things I discovered, you know, like borrowings from other books and, you know, tapping that both of them copied. I also found, you know, the recipes used, the like zirbaja, sikbaj, those sweet and sour stews or apricot stews. Of course, you know, I found that the recipes are, you know, they are describing the same recipes, but of course the details are different.
Huh, interesting. Yeah. Well, I want to talk more about some of those details and those recipes, yeah. Pigeons, fish, wonderful things, when we come back after our short break. So stay with us. I like making crackers. Crackers are easy and kind of foolproof, too. And recently I've been making flaxseed crackers. You just take some flour, all-purpose flour, maybe Bob's Red Mill all-purpose flour, and salt, very important, a little bit of baking soda, and seeds or any kind of grains that you like. And I am particularly fond of making flaxseed crackers. Bob's Red Mill offers a great variety of seeds and grains, but their flaxseed is really good, and it's good to sprinkle on your cereal in the morning, or gives you that extra nutrition that you won't find in any other way. But in the flaxseed crackers, it adds a little variety to the crunch, and I like that. It's not a nut, and it's not a large seed. It's small enough that it's chewable, and you get this flavor that you're not quite sure what you're eating, but I'm sure it comes from the fact that it's a good seed and it's processed well. Bob's Red Mill offers, as I said, a lot of variety of seeds and grains, and their milled products are all top-notch. You can find out all about their products on bobsredmill.com, and don't forget to use the code TASTEPOD for 25% off your order. And I said, oh, I wanna go. Hi, we're back, and I'm speaking with Nawal Nasrallah, and she has translated The Treasure Trove of Benefits and Variety of the Table, an incredible compendium, as I mentioned at the top of the show, of recipes. I'm not even going to begin to tell you all the types of recipes in it, and I'm sure, Nawal, you would not have the energy to go through all of them either. But you mentioned earlier about fish and pigeons. Fish, I want to talk about first. There was the Egyptians were known for their interesting agricultural practice, and there are so many recipes for fish. Aha, we discover why. Yeah. Why yeah. is that?
Yeah. Well, you know, because of the the location, you know, geographical location of Egypt. It's at the Mediterranean Sea, the Red Sea. There is the Great River Nile. So there are lots of sources for fish, different kinds of fishes. Some of them are, sea fishes. Some of them are river fishes. And they were all used, the big ones, the small ones. The big ones, for example, in the cans are used fresh, whereas we have recipes for using the anchovies, which are like sardines, you know, small mm-hmm. sardines. And they were used... Sometimes in the recipes they are used fresh, and in some of the recipes the recipe calls for salt cured anchovies. You know, like the anchovies we have mm-hmm. we buy today in tins or something, and they are seasoned and they taste lovely. I mean, I encourage people to try it, to buy anchovies and try the recipe. It would be lovely, you know, with lemon juice, with olive oil, with the spices. It's really lovely. And
the freshwater fish, I mean, their practice of flooding the Nile. Talk about that.
Yeah, the Nile, that's really a big thing in Egypt, even from ancient times. All visitors, they marvel at the way it flowed, you know, the opposite way from the south to north. I mean, they are familiar with rivers flowing from north to south, but this one they found strange. Of course, we find certain, so many writers wrote about the Nile. They said that it flowed from paradise. And because of the flooding, the regular flooding of the Nile, of course, it was they looked forward to it. You know, unlike floods in other areas like in Mesopotamia, you know, in Iraq, they were catastrophes mm-hmm. because they happened in spring when the crops had just come out, so they destroy everything. But in Egypt, it was the opposite, exactly the opposite. It was regular. The River Nile starts rising slowly in the summer until in September it reaches its highest level, and then it floods and covers the all the lands around it. And when it recedes, of course, behind it, it leaves a fertile soil, which was really, you know, very good for, you know, growing plants and also for making excellent pottery. So these were their, I mean, two things they made from this, you know, excellent soil. Mm-hmm. And, you know, of course, there is this funny story about Herodotus. He marveled, of course, like the rest, at the Nile when he visited it in the 4th century or 5th century B.C., and he said their river flows from south to north, and which gave him, I don't know, the impression that Egyptians do things the opposite way. That yeah. Women, for example, they piss sitting, standing, and men do it sitting. I don't know this.
Well, he was drawing some very strange conclusions, yeah. Indeed. Yeah, but the fish. Yeah. But I mean, you mentioned that the children, even children, were yes. catching a lot yeah. of fish during the flooding period.
So yeah, because they get trapped. You know, when the river flows, it flows to the lands, and of course, when it recedes, it leaves all those puddles and streams. I mean, water. Ponds of water, and then the fish would be trapped in it, and even kids would be able to catch the fish for their family. So mm-hmm. it was, so the flooding of the Nile was really a way of life for the Egyptians.
Yeah, and the pigeons, their love of pigeons,
and which the pigeons yeah. from ancient times. You know, there is evidence that they made those coats. All over Egypt, they made
look like they look like beehives almost.
Like beehives, yeah. You know, like domed constructions of clay, and they made holes in them, and like a vessel, you know, attached to it. So when these were to attract the wild pigeons, because they didn't for food, they liked to use those, you know, the eggs hatched from those wild pigeons. So then when the wild pigeons come to those and settle in those coats, they would lay their eggs, they would hatch, and they would use these. They would grow into, young pigeons because they favored the plump young pigeons, you know, for their dishes. They mm-hmm. called it firakh hamam. Even today, you can still find those coats all along the River Nile, especially in the Delta area. And I have read that, of course, we know that ful, you know, the fava beans is the national dish of the Egyptians. And a writer says, stuffed pigeons, firakh mahshi, is the unofficial national dish of Egypt, huh. Even today.
Even today, right.
There is and also, I forgot to mention, you know, about chicken. I mean, chicken is, when you read Ken's, you see that chicken features a lot in those recipes. And when you read how, I mean, when we read, of course, I read in about how they used to get those chickens. They had the artificial incubators. They found a way of, hatching, I mean, all those eggs. They would use a courtyard mm-hmm. with several artificial incubators. Each incubator would be enough for 1,000 eggs or something. And there were workers, and they made the incubator to look like a chicken. It was warm, and they would turn the eggs periodically, like the mother chicken would, you know, like the chicken would do. And they would test its temperature by putting the eggs on their eyelids, like the chicken does, uh-huh. and until they hatch, and then of course. they had chickens. They grow them into and they, like in chickens.
So they were they had this chicken industry going long before anyone else.
Yes, and they call it Ma'mal al-Firakh, which is a chicks factory.
Not unlike today, for sure, at all. Well, in fact, and there was a, there are quite a few recipes that I noticed for chicken, and one caught my eye that I just can't wait to try. And it brings me to another point in that it was a recipe for sweetened chicken with pistachios. Yeah. Now, there's a lot of sugar used in a lot of these recipes. Yeah. Let's talk about sugar a little bit.
Yeah, sugar. Well, that's, you know, I mean, you mentioned the sweet chicken. It was a typically Egyptian dish. Even, you know, we have accounts of visitors to the region. And they report that, I mean, they give the impression that this was an exclusively Egyptian dish. So a lot of sugar. Well, you know, sugar came with the Arabs. When the Arabs spread in the, you know, in the areas and then they came with to Egypt, they brought with them certain plants. And sugar cane was one of them, in addition to eggplant, taro, citron trees, and they all proved to be to grow successfully, of course, due to the fertility of the Nile Delta.
Mm-hmm.
So sugar industry was really a booming business. I mean, they had so many factories and producing several stages of refined sugar until you have the they call sukkar mukarrar, which is the white sugar, the whitest sugar you can find.
Mm-hmm.
And this used to import. It was a valuable commodity that was import. They used to export to other places. But they used, of course, there were other kinds like brown sugar, molasses, several grades of molasses. You know, from the cheap ones to the more expensive ones, from refined sugar. So there was sugar everywhere, and we can see reflected in this book. You know, it's everywhere, even in sauces, you know, like...
Yeah, it was very
sauces.
Interesting, to see the use of it.
The dessert section has, I don't know what, 80 recipes of dessert.
Unbelievable,
you know. And there's also something else, you know. Sugar also it was associated. I mean, I found from my readings it was associated with the, you know, the addiction to hashish, which is marijuana.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, this was they considered it a social affliction, and they wrote about it. Al-Maqrizi, our historian who wrote about Egypt, he also wrote about it, and he said it started with the. Sufis, because it inhibited their appetite, but then of course it spread to other, especially to the poorer, slices of society. They even called it hashishat al-fuqara, which is marijuana of the poor, because it was, you know. Ibn al-Baytar, the herbalist, the 12th century herbalist, described how the Egyptians do it. He said they will grind the plant, they mix it with sesame, sugar, and eat it. And it suppressed their hunger, you know, because they have no money. So what do? They just eat this to suppress their hunger. And what's more, they said it was also, you know, it also dried semen, so and suppressed sexual appetite, so it's so less kids, less money spent, etc. So you know, there's a book written in the 15th century by Ibn Sudun. He talks about, you know, part of it. He talks about his cravings for sugar, and this was reflected in his poetry. He mentions, I mean, I noticed that a lot of, he mentions, you know, sugar and pastries and all these syrupy desserts in his poetry, you know. Of course, I was happy to see this because it enabled me to, you know, find the correct pronunciation, for example, of certain names of recipes. Of desserts. I wasn't sure in the cans and etc. But he's trying to talk about this social ill in a kind of humorous way, and tries to expose it. And of course, we all know he himself was an hashish addict, so he knows how he knows how it was.
Right. A couple of points that I want to have you touch on before we have to end, and that is talking about there are recipes in there not necessarily for edible mm-hmm. foods, but also, and then to the other question I wanted to ask were the types of spices that were very common and any ingredients that were surprising that we don't see anymore that you might have found. Let's start with the ingredients that maybe we don't use or find or know that much about anymore.
First of all, of course we know mastic gum.
Yes.
But I was surprised to find that mastic is used with savory dishes a lot, especially dishes that have meat in them. Mm-hmm. I mean, I was surprised because from the Al-Warraq's book, I looked carefully and they only occur in desserts. Hmm. And that's how we use them today. But then, of course, the reason is when you read about what the physicians thought of the air in Egypt. They thought it was putrid, mm-hmm. humid, and hot. And of course, the meat. They said that the lamb, the mutton they used, it had a strong smell. So I think that mastic was used just to, to remove this smell and because of the properties in mastic to combat putridity in in foods.
Right. So
I also noticed that the recipes use a lot of lemon juice, sour grape juice, pomegranate juice, a lot, in most of the recipes. And when you read about some of them say that is because the water of the Nile was too sweet, so they needed to use these things.
Sour and, agent, right?
Yes, yeah. And also they said because of the putridity, humidity, and the heat of their air, they needed certain cold things to combat these, harmful properties of the air.
Yeah. A word about some of the recipes in there, because the book is about the entire habits and culture of dining and eating, and of course that is cleanliness and smells.
Yeah.
Perfumes.
Yeah.
So mention that a little bit. There's recipes for things like that in there too, as well.
Yeah, there are a lot of recipes. Yeah, I think the writer of Cairns wanted the dining experience to be a complete one.
Mm-hmm.
Starting, you don't only eat food, but you also have to take care of what happens after food. You need to wash your hands. You need to anoint your face, the beard, the fingers to get rid of, because they use their fingers to eat the food, and they have to get rid of all those smells. They had to cleanse the dining area by sprinkling distilled waters. So we have recipes for hand washing preparations. We have recipes for certain powders that you can sprinkle here and there to, improve the smell of the area. We have also incense preparations, and we have potpourri. There's a recipe for potpourri, which is put in a long-necked bottle, which mm-hmm. is called feyasha, and they put it in corridors, they put it in toilets to improve their smells. So this book, I think that it caters to the entire body and not only to the, to satisfying the appetite.
Right, a book of housekeeping as well. Right?
Yes, yeah.
Well,
housekeeping, yes, because it also talks about how to preserve fresh fruits. until they are not in season and all that, you know, and
It's really a source of so much. You've given scholars a lot to work with as far as anyone wanting to learn more about Egyptian cuisine and the heritage of such. But also for people who, if it's their own heritage, they're wanting to know, you know, where did some of these foods begin? Where did things start? I think it's as I say, also an eminently cookable book. It's you can just to use the recipes. A little daunting, there are so many of them.
Yeah.
But it also shows a lot of the influences of those dishes on today's modern cuisine and Middle Eastern cuisine is so, and Egyptian cuisine seems to be so hot right now, especially. You know?
Yeah. And I found so many similarities between, I mean, the techniques used then and the techniques used now. So I think for people, I mean, that's why I dedicate my book to two young people, Sara Sayed and Bassem Khalifa. They are the ones who started the chapter of slow food in Egypt. And I mean, the slow food movement depends on, they want to go back to traditional way of cooking to combat, you know, fast food. The invasion of fast food.
Right.
And this book, of course, you know, it's a wealth of information to go back to heritage. I mean, heritage is important. It's a way of self-discovery.
That's right.
So this is really a delicious way of discovering oneself.
Yeah. Well, it was a delight. And the color plates that are in it. How many of those came from, I mean, were they in the earliest manuscript, do you think? Or were they added at subsequent times?
The illustrations, the
plates.
I found them in different museums, but the illustrations that are taken from the book are the manuscript, you know, folio pages from the manuscript. But the other illustrations, they were taken from other books,
other
but
sources,
dealing with the same period. So, you know, I wanted to show like what porcelain was like at the time. Cooking pots were at the time, so this is, you know, the book wasn't illustrated. Itself wasn't illustrated.
Okay, that was what I wanted to know. Well, before we sign off, just tell our listeners where they can find some of your adaptations of the recipes. Your blog,
the medieval Egyptian kitchen. My website. I started it especially for this book.
Medieval Egyptian Kitchen.
The medieval Egyptian kitchen.
Okay, terrific. So people can find those.
Well, they just Google my name and they find everything. You know,
they will find that. Naval, it has been a pleasure, as always.
Well, and thank you for having me.
And I urge anyone who's interested in this to try to snag a copy or go to the library, get the copy, and use it. It's, once again, Treasure Trove of Benefits and Variety at the Table, a 14th century Egyptian cookbook, and it's introduced, the introduction, the glossary, wonderful glossary, by the way, and translated by Nawal Nasrallah. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And thank you for listening. Again, this has been another Taste of the Past.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
A Taste of the Past is powered by Simplecast. Simplecast is a popular hosting and analytics platform that allows podcasters to easily host and publish to apps like Apple Podcasts. If you have a podcast or are looking to create your very first, check it out. Try it for free and save half off your first 3 months at simplecast.com/heritage.
Hi, listeners. We want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Aweli, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries. Like, why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode? Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.